It's probably certainly given Matt's talk, it's worth noting as he's representing HHS, I also work at the Department of State, but I am here completely in my academic capacity and not representing the Department of State or the U.S. government in any way. I also want to mention I co-direct a research team at George Washington that looks at global health security. And our work on global health diplomacy goes back a bit, about 15 years at this point, between negotiating treaty language, building public health capacity programs on the ground, all over the world, working with ministries of health, agriculture, defense, also in all corners of the world. Most of that work focused on building capacity under the international health regulations. And we've also done a lot of work on diplomacy training materials for courses, both for the United States government and for now graduate students. So we've been playing in this space a while. And, there's a sticker on here that says, I've donated today, have you? So, put that aside. Not today. So, we didn't coordinate terribly well. So Matt talked about this already, but I'm going to bore you all and just briefly touch on it again. So this whole area of global health diplomacy is evolving, as Matt's just discussed. And a couple years back, we really were struck by the fact that people were using the words health diplomacy in very different ways. So we did present this taxonomy and published it in 2011. Looking at both and coming up with terms for core multi-stakeholder and informal diplomacy. And again, at the risk of being a little repetitive, this first area of core global health diplomacy, and as Matt mentioned, is really the negotiations between and among nations. So trying to resolve disputes, enact formal agreements, bilateral, multilateral. It's good old-fashioned diplomacy. So it's where nations negotiate, agree to binding agreements, laws, norms, standards, and especially, as Matt has discussed, really conducted by foreign affairs specialists or diplomats with input from technical experts. But it's not technical experts actually doing the work. And there's obviously been a lot of this. Depending on how you count and what you count, we have approximately 50 multilateral agreements that focus on health. And then we also have that area, the next thing down in the pyramid, which is multi-stakeholder diplomacy, the international negotiations, interactions between various state and non-state and multilateral actors. So these are groups coming together to negotiate agreements, guidance, coordinated action plans, and it's where you have diplomats working side by side with technical experts and private sector leaders. And these may result in MOUs, campaigns to eradicate disease, ceasefires to conduct a public health vaccination campaign, alliances between nations, private sector, philanthropic organizations working together on a particular issue, like, say, HIV. And then that final area on the bottom part of the pyramid, that informal category, which are interactions between public health actors and their counterparts. So this may be government officials working in the field with host governments, researchers, private funders. It may be somebody not at all affiliated with the government but happens to hold a passport of a certain country and, whether they know it or not, is representing their country and their interactions with their counterparts in the host country. What's really interesting is that, especially if you go back to Matt's pyramid, this is where just by numbers, the bulk of interactions are taking place, but this is also where many of the actors don't even realize that they are contributing to a larger context, that their actions, good or bad, may influence relationships between nations. So we came up with the taxonomy, great. But the field is really still very much developing. And we, actually all of us, all of you, we're really trying to build the evidence base, but it's happening basically one anecdote at a time. And we're trying to assess exactly what type of interventions enhance stability and health, especially in maybe complex humanitarian environments. How do you actually measure soft power? And what metrics do you use? And are there any best practices for how we build public health relationships? And do these successes then actually influence foreign policy? We don't know. I mean, literally, we are trying to figure out how we capture this type of information and pull from other disciplines that spend some more time actually trying to figure this out and present it back in a way that we then have a series of best practices that then can feed back into MAPS competency models. So thinking about this evidence base, try maybe a little theory. So I was working with Holly Greb and Shrinkita Mukherjee, and we identified a theory of change approach as one way to conceptualize global health diplomacy practice and impact and try to depict some of the complexity and identify some of the relationships and pathways for measuring success. We published this, I guess, a couple years back. Within the last couple years in the Journal of Global Health Diplomacy. And what we tried to do was first map, I'm going to see if I can read it carefully. It's probably really hard to see up there. We tried to map first the diverse set of stakeholders and their motivations and some of the mutual objectives for health and diplomacy, and then taking those channels, so core, multi-stakeholder, and informal channels for global health diplomacy, to see how you then achieve those mutual objectives. We then map the contributions of the activities themselves in terms of immediate and long-term outcomes. Ideally, how to improve both diplomatic relationships and shared global health benefits. We then selected Myanmar as a case study, as a test primarily because the U.S., at the time we were looking at this, had just recently renewed official ties with the country with little previous engagement. And we hypothesized that this country would allow us to use this theory of change approach with more clarity than maybe some of the other longer standing engagements around the world. Also, the regional dynamics made Myanmar a good case study, partly because of the long standing embargo on U.S. diplomatic engagements. And health was very much intertwined with diplomatic leverage, and as well as security interests in the country. Especially around the U.S. involvement in regional infectious disease and humanitarian response. We also felt that an in-depth exploration of U.S.-Myanmar engagement would provide maybe a timely example of how diverse stakeholders in a single country can contribute to global health diplomacy and maybe some of the resulting impacts in global health. With a very brief detour, talk briefly about the country itself. Population of about 53 million, life expectancy of about 66. There's over 135 different ethnic groups. It's a mostly Buddhist country, but there's certainly been ongoing conflict with some of the minority groups, including the Muslim Rohingya, who are not officially recognized by the Burmese government and have recently been subject of evening news reports. On the health side, the country suffers both from NCDs, and at the same time, they're battling HIV, TB, malaria, and other infectious diseases. Decades of political and economic isolation in the country leave it one of the poorest in Southeast Asia. In 2000, WHO ranked the health system among the very weakest in the world, second to last, actually. But since reforms began, the country's made substantial progress. The government has quadrupled its health budget and developed what they call Myanmar Health Vision 2030, which is an overarching framework for health reform, committing the country to providing universal health coverage by 2030, as well as aiming to basically improve the overall population health status. But there's certainly large disparities in healthcare and access to care around the country, and certainly between the various regions and ethnic groups, rich and poor, urban and rural populations. By the way, these are all the source from this and the previous slide are from the WHO. And it's also worth noting that approximately 70% of the country, of the population, lives in malaria endemic regions. HIV is getting better, but there's still very high areas of transmission, and it has one of the highest TB burdens in the world, including MDR and XDR TB. The recent political history has certainly been very interesting. There was the quick background. This is like the Cliff Notes version here. There's the military coup in 62, followed by about two decades of sporadic violence, political oppression, UN citations of human rights violations. The U.S., among many others, imposed pretty strict financial sanctions. But there was a bit of a thaw, and in 2010, there was a general election. The opposition leader was released from house arrest. Slowly, a lot of the sanctions have been lifted. And in 2011, the U.S. announced looser restrictions on development assistance, including international help. And it's during this recent period that there have been kind of dramatically increased efforts by the United States government, mostly by USAID and the Department of Defense, to engage around development and health assistance. A lot of work on HIV, artemisinin-resistant malaria, MDR-TB, maternal mortality, infant mortality, and basic overall health system strengthening. And so we were able to then identify some of these major elements and take it back to that theory of change template and use the case for U.S. Myanmar global health diplomacy related activities and provide some details for how these elements are working together. And I think what we were able to show was that you had this diverse array of stakeholders and actors and the five mutual objectives, and that there was documentation that those channels for health diplomacy, those core informal multi-stakeholder, actually were all in use at the same time by various actors. And it showed that I think that while the diversity of stakeholders is wide, and they're engaging through a wide variety of strategies, each strategy is then pursued through multiple channels. But these strategies, channels, and contributions to global health diplomacy are all overlapping. Basically, it's messy, right? But and I think what this gets at, even in a case where engagement's relatively recent, and you would think kind of clean, given how recent it is and how few actors relative to other engagements in other countries there are, it still shows just how complex this is. But it also shows that we're still trying to figure out what is happening and how you actually measure those ultimate outcomes. Now, while we're kind of waiting for the evidence to occur, so we can figure out, then go back and analyze it and see what works and what doesn't work and then build it into a competency model. While we're doing all that, we teach. So a number of years back, we went through an exercise that maybe a little more informal than Matt's process, where we spoke to and interviewed people who had been operating as global health diplomats, whether they knew it or not, to figure out what are the skills and the tools and the resources that they wish they had had in their job before they went into it. So we spoke to admirals and ambassadors and health attachés and foreign service officers and folks from the Department of Defense who are working in the overseas laboratories and tried to figure out what were all these skills. And they were different depending on which job somebody had. Often the language skill was mentioned. But what pretty much everybody talked about was the need for better negotiating skills, whether that's, you know, at the, you know, in the World Health Assembly in Geneva, or just negotiating something for your laboratory. So one of the things we focus on when we teach global health diplomacy is negotiating. Again, whether it's one of these core channels or one of the examples we work on is how to negotiate within the United States government, which is complicated. So we've been using this case study as an example for a while, where the objective is to develop a coherent U.S. policy framework for a whole government to set priorities for health engagement in Myanmar. And all of our students are assigned a government agency, and they are assigned to produce. They are designated as the technical expert who needs to write up the talking points for their senior official to go to an interagency policy committee and negotiate on behalf of their agency and their equities to come up with consensus priorities for engagement. And we don't leave them out. You know, we give them a little bit of guidance, and they each get assigned, let's say, one of these government agencies. We give them some background information on the agency itself, what they've done historically, what their equities are. We don't expect everybody to know, you know, what commerce thinks they're going to get out of this, which is DOD versus the intelligence community. So they all go back, they do a little bit of homework, and then we hold a mock interagency policy committee. And students then come and negotiate on behalf of their agency by providing, as you can see, you know, we run this as a regular IPC, where USAID and DOD have to talk about their historic engagement. And then we go around the table. Everybody gets a minute to say what their proposals are. And then we walk through those priorities and challenges and how to actually achieve what we think are going to be those highest priorities, and then they have to come up with recommendations for the principals at the next level meeting. It's been a really interesting exercise, and I think one that our students get a lot out of, while at the same time trying to get smart about a particular engagement while they're building their negotiating skills. So this is what we teach, and while I said we wait for the evidence to come rolling in, this is a big week where there will be an election on the 8th, and we see what happens. You know, I don't know if you can then walk away from the election and say, oh yes, our work on maternal child health helps sway the election. We can't do that. But I think it's just one more data point in mapping out these relationships and where we are successful, where we're not successful, and how do we even define what that means. So in the meantime, you know, we keep trying to come up with different ways to explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think a quick takeaway is we have found the theory of change model is a useful tool to aid both in designing and evaluating global health diplomacy efforts. But we certainly need to further develop this and every other tool we can come up with, because I think this is really important stuff, and it's a little bit of the future of where we're going. And if we can figure out better ways to capture it, then we can figure out what are those best pathways to get the results that we want, and then we can figure out how we teach it. So with that, I want to thank these guys for inviting me to be on the panel today, and thank you all for being here.